Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today in digest format, World Radio Magazine online version for March 2009. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 225 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Nancy Gott, WZHC, and the editorial director, Richard S. Mawson, W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, in lowercase, handyham@courage.org. Handyham is spelled one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, at courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. Again, my name is Bob Zeta. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, down in southeastern Mass, right on Buzzards Bay near Cape Cod. So let's begin the online version of World Radio Magazine for March 2009. Starting with the editorial log by Nancy Cott, WC8C. The premier issue of World Radio Online debuted to rave reviews from around the world. Ralph, ZL2AOH, wrote, "I just downloaded the new mag, a very fine effort. It prints nicely as an A5 size booklet." George, W7POE, said, "I am very, very impressed with World Radio Online. I was formerly a subscriber to World Radio, but dropped it last year for no good reason except was getting just too much reading material. However, I am happy to be able to get this neat little publication online now and have already read a good part of it." Bob, K9KNI, tells us, "I want to congratulate you and all concerned with the first issue of World Radio Online. It really looks terrific, and the color is wonderful. I know it is still a work in progress, but you are off to a great start." Thousands of people have signed up for the WRO email notification list, which will send an automated message to your inbox to let you know that the next issue is ready for viewing. Murphy did pay a visit, causing a glitch in the confirmation process. After you enroll, you will receive a confirmation email to verify that your email address works, but that bug has hopefully been worked out. Sorry for any aggravation that may have caused. You can join the notification list at http://www.cq-amateurradio.com/world-radio.html. Just click on the red box where it says sign up now. We love hearing your compliments about our magazine, but we also appreciate hearing about any problems you may have when trying to view it. We realize it is a large file. The February issue was 12 megabytes, and many people are still on modem dial-up. We are working on different options to make opening the file online easier. One suggestion that Rich Mawson, our editorial director, makes is to try downloading instead of opening the file. To do this in Internet Explorer, instead of left-clicking a mouse on the issue cover, right-click, and then click on Save Target As. You will be prompted to pick a directory and a file name, and then click OK to start downloading. The speed of the download will depend on the speed of your Internet connection. Once it's downloaded, find the file in your selected directory and double-click on it. This should open the Adobe Acrobat Reader and the file. The county hunters among us will notice that Dennis Hall's quarterly county hunter column is not in this issue. Since CQ Magazine sponsors the USA Counties Award USA-CA, and a topic is covered extensively in CQ Magazine, the decision was made to discontinue the column. Dennis is both, quoting, happy and sad about this. He has been wanting to spend more time on his personal life and hobbies and talked with me a couple of years ago about discontinuing the column. But I twisted his arm and convinced him to write it quarterly instead of bi-monthly. He is happy that he can have one less thing on his plate, but sad because he will miss the interaction with his readers. Dennis is going to start a blog on his webpage so you can keep in touch with him. The URL isn't available at press time, but when I find out what it is, I will be sure to let you know. Thank you, Dennis, for all your work over the years and the best of luck in your county hunting endeavors. As always, we need your stories about your club activities and ham adventures, so please send them along. Doc files and JPG attachments work best, but we can work with just about anything. It's signed 7388 Nancy Cott, WZ8C, WRO editor. Nancy's email address at CQ Magazine is her call WZ8C@CQ-amateur-radio.com. I find some interesting commentary here in World Radio Online Newsfront. First one particularly, solar storms could bring disaster. A new study from the National Academy of Sciences outlines dire consequences on Earth for a worst-case scenario giant solar storm. Scientists involved in the study say that the damage to power grids and other communication systems could be catastrophic. While the sun is now in a lull period, solar activity is expected to rise sharply in coming years, and what is known as severe space weather will ramp up a year or two before the peak in 2012. At its worst, severe space weather in the form of solar flares and other phenomena can produce a storm electromagnetic energy. Once it hits Earth, it can disrupt power distribution grids and cause blackouts, and also downgrade both terrestrial wireline and satellite to ground communications. Severe solar storms can even damage satellites if they are not fully hardened against radiation. Ground-based communications, especially on the high-frequency bands used by most radio amateurs, would also be adversely impacted by such a solar event. Daniel Baker, the director of the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, was the lead researcher in this study. He says that in the event of a high-magnitude solar storm, that the social impact could be enormous. Emergency services could wind up being strained, and command and control might be lost. The National Academy of Science says that its prediction is based in part on a major solar attack back in 1859. That storm is believed to be the reason that telegraph systems short-circuited in both the United States and Europe. According to the new study, with the advent of modern computer-controlled power grids and relay satellites on orbit, much more is at risk. The report was commissioned and funded by NASA. Experts from around the world in industry, government, and academia participated. Next, we have an article about the FCC's activities. FCC says no to citizens' challenge of radio station license. A citizen's request that the FCC deny the renewal of the license of a non-commercial radio station has been turned down by the agency. Way back on January 24, 2005, that is a long time ago, isn't it, folks? Creative Educational Media filed for renewal of the license of its non-commercial educational station called KMSI-FM. On April 29, 2005, William Crozier filed an informal objection alleging that Creative lacked local programming and challenging its nonprofit status. Creative filed its opposition on May 12, 2005. The FCC agreed with Creative, and on July 13, 2007, it released a staff decision which both denied Crozier's objection and granted the KMSI renewal application. At that time, the FCC said that there was no substantial and material question of fact that a grant of the renewal application would be inconsistent with the Commission's Act. On August 21, 2007, Crozier filed a petition for reconsideration, still claiming that Creative still lacked local programming, Now, in its January 9, 2009 announcement, the Federal Communications Commission noted that Crozier's petition was late filed and was being dismissed on that basis. The FCC adds that this action is consistent with the D.C. Circuit's decisions on whether the Commission has failed to adhere to its procedural rules for providing notice of its decisions. It notes that no such circumstances are present here. That was submitted by the Federal Communications Commission, ladies and gentlemen. Our next Newsfront piece, CQ to accept EQSL for awards programs. CQ Magazine says that effective immediately, it will begin accepting contact confirmations made on the EQSL electronic QSO validation system for its operating awards. According to CQ editor Rick Mawson, W2VU, there will be certain limitations and procedural differences for different awards, at least at the start. Only confirmations from, quoting, authenticity guaranteed, close quote, members of EQSL will be accepted. This means that in accordance with existing EQSL policy, the membership level of bronze or higher is required in order to participate in award programs via EQSL. According to Mawson, this is the first time that CQ has formally accepted anything other than traditional paper QSL cards for its awards. He says that CQ has been working with EQSL's David Morris, called N5UP, and his team for several months to assure that the integrity of the awards program will be protected. They also had to create mechanisms to make it easy for both award applicants and managers to use EQSL credits toward CQ-sponsored awards. More information about how the CQ-EQSL-based system will work is online on the awards page at www.cq-amateur-radio.com. Information on EQSL is on the World Wide Web at www.eqsl.cc. That material was furnished by the publication CQ. Here's some good news. The number of new amateurs entering the hobby has risen substantially for the second straight year, according to the ARRL. In 2006, before the FCC removed the Morse code requirements for all levels of ham licenses, there were just over 21,000 newcomers to the hobby. In 2007, that number jumped to 26,728, and in July 2008 was just over 28,000. The ARRL also reported that upgrade applications continued to be very strong, with more than double the number of upgrades in 2008 than in 2006. In 2007, the number of upgrades versus 2006 rose nearly 300%. The total U.S. ham population at the end of 2008 was 663,500, an increase of 1.2% from 2007. That number could be deceptive, however, considering that the numbers of new licensees show that more than 100,000 new hams have joined our ranks in just the past 4 years. For some of you people that are really interested in outer space, catch this one, Ham Radio on Venus. This is the March issue, not April, so this is for real. The Japan Amateur Radio League, JARL, and JAMSTAT, the Japanese Amateur Satellite Organizations, are working with the Japanese University Space Engineering Consortium to send an amateur radio payload to Venus as part of the JAXA Planet C Venus Orbiter mission planned for next year. According to the AMSAT News Service, Unit Tech 1 will transmit a CW beacon at about 1 bit per second. Hams around the world will be invited to listen for the signal and to help with two major science goals, one being development of technologies to receive and decode very weak and low bit rate signals coming from deep space, and two, development of technologies to estimate the orbit of the satellite and the Doppler shift of its signal based on the received RF signals. These technologies will be necessary for tracking and receiving signals from satellites in deep space. More information in English is available on the UNITEC-1 website. That's UNITEC-1 website. I think it's time now to check out our first piece, Contesting 101 and 201, the author Dave Bell, called W6AQ. The Thursday before the official start of the Dayton Hamvention has gotten to be a busy and must-do day for a lot of conventioneers. The QR peers start FDIM, that's 4 days in May, on that day, and fill the holiday in Fairborn, which is south by Wright-Patterson, not too far from the Hera Arena, above the swarm of hams descending on Dayton. I attended FDIM once a few years ago, and since then I've done a few contests using QRP and built a KX1 that always goes with me on my holidays. I threw a 26-foot wire antenna over the fiberglass roof of a small tour boat on the Amazon River and workstations in Germany, as well as all over South America, so don't scoff at 2 watts. But that's another story. Last year I was in Dayton early to be a student at Contest University, and what a great education it was. The creme de la creme of contesters were the professors, and wow, W-O-W, were these guys good. The Contest University chairman is Tim Duffy, K-3-L-R. If that call is unfamiliar to you, you most assuredly aren't a contester. But it's never too late to start, and see you. It's a great primer and motivator. For years, I have considered myself a casual contester, which is probably an oxymoron, but it's also a large and valuable category for the big dog contesters. Because if there weren't casual contesters, who would the big guys work after they'd all worked each other? Thursday started at 7 a.m. with a complimentary buffet breakfast and ended a little after 5 p.m. Lunch was delivered to you in your classroom seat. That Tim Duffy is a real slave driver. It's easier to see why his big multi-station does so well. The first class for both first-year students and graduate students was Radio Contesting Ethics, taught by Randy, K5ZD. Contest ethics is all about what you do when nobody is looking. It's about running more power than your category allows. That's a real temptation when you're running QRP and haven't nailed that loud rare one after 20 calls. Randy tweaked everyone's conscience. Doug Grant, K1DG, taught Station Design 201. And even though I have a fairly simple station, I was furiously making notes in my textbook. The moment I got home, I pulled my K3 toward me about 6 inches, and got a draw for my keyboard, and lowered my computer screen about 3 inches so I no longer have to move my head when looking from rig to monitor. I also moved my Palstar AT Auto about 8 inches closer, so it was quicker to get my antennas SWR down to 1-to-1. If you've never heard Ward and Zero AX speak to a gathering of hams, you have missed a great show. If you're a Ward Silver fan, you know that every talk is different, fresh, witty, and information-packed. At CU, Ward did hints and kinks for contests 1 and 2. I was in his graduate-level class, since someone at CU figured I had been in too many contests to take first-level courses. After I catered lunch, K1DG took the stage again for a couple of quickie sessions to get everybody back up to speed. One of them was an eyeball sprint, which I flunked. I'm going to have to try a real sprint someday, if I can find the adrenaline somewhere. Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZ, is a very well-known contester who told an audience of lowbenders that there's fun to be had on the very highs and ultra-highs, which with grid squares and rovers and passing stations from band to band, is a very different and strange animal. Add to that the fact that many VHF ops don't know the code, don't know how to contest, and try to make all of their contacts on the calling frequency, at least in Southern California, and what you have is a challenge to put it lightly. Frank, W3LPL, gave two sessions on antennas and propagation, and K8MR did one on de-expeditioning, which I missed because they were concurrent with something I needed to know more. And you can be there in 2009. For all of the tempting details, go to the following website, www.contestuniversity.com. That's two words, Contest University. I'll say again, www.contestuniversity.com. There is a tuition involved, so take a look at that on the website. It's really not too expensive and probably a great deal of fun just doing it and then using the information derived from that experience on the air. Now, folks, remember, I digest this material, so this is a shortened version of the actual article, which was much more complicated to read. 73 from The Graduate. And I'll see you on the radio. The author is Dave Bell, called W6AQ, Whiskey 6 Alpha, Quebec. Our next featured piece has us in the Twilight Zone. It's titled The Hamp Radio Twilight Zone. The author is Ed McLaughlin, called W6OLA. I don't know if the sunspot cycle is far enough along, if there really is a hole in the ozone layer, if it is a Murphy working his magic, or if I really did enter the Twilight Zone. But I think the recent experience in ham radio is worth a visit. Let me begin by setting the stage. I was first licensed in 1960 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as KN3NJT. I had two friends that were hams and acted as my Elmers. We were all teenagers. Yes, the term Elmer was old even then. I was into shortwave listening for many years, having been immersed in a hobby with an old Farnsworth AM-FM-SW radio given to me by an aunt and uncle. One evening while tuning around on the radio, a new AM signal wiped out the bands. It was really loud and broadbanded. I knew it was close. The next day, I noticed a large shiny beam in the backyard of the house next door. A new tenant was renting the apartment on the first floor of that house, and the source of my RF I was quickly discovered. I knocked on the door of the apartment and met a teen about my age. I asked about the antenna. He told me about amateur radio. Wham! I was hooked from the first moment. I wanted to talk to the folks I had been listening to. My new friend and neighbor was Jody, called K3JZD. I soon met Terry, K3HKR, one of his ham friends, who was also about the same age. They opened a new world for me. They acted as my guide through the rules and regulations and made me keep at it until I could send and receive good CW. Thanks to their prodding, I soon upgraded to K3NJT and met many other Pittsburgh area hams along the way. We all had our cool cars with whip antennas and vibrator power supplies to run our rigs. Do you remember Heathkit, Towers, Sixers, and Tenors? I still have mine. We moved through high school, girlfriends, and part-time jobs hamming all the way. After high school, we seemed to drift apart as college, military service, or full-time jobs made more demands on our time. My path took me into a career as a radio announcer in the Pittsburgh area, and then into the U.S. Navy. Because of my ham background, I became a radio man in the Navy and traveled from the U.S. to the Caribbean, the Mediterranean, and Europe. Ham radio was a part of my travels. As I had obtained permission to bring my rig aboard and use it during my off-duty hours. After my hitch in the Navy was up, I went back into radio announcing and then into sales. My sales career lasted 35 years and saw me transferred from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Southern California to Washington State. Along the way, I traded K3NJT for the call W6OLA. Finally retired, I purchased a logging program and started inputting all my logs, starting with my novice days through today. I found a lot of the QSLs from my old buddies and Elmers in various shoeboxes and had a neat idea. Why not scan their old QSL cards into my computer, write them a letter, and include the printed scan of their old card? I found most of them on QRZ.com and put my plan into action. Now for the Twilight Zone part. The very evening of the day I had mailed all the letters, I was cruising 80 meters and heard the call sign K3HKR. I did a double take, not a triple take. It was like, wow. I had not heard or spoken to any of my old ham pals in Pittsburgh for more than 40 years, and here was one pouring out of my speaker. I called them on frequency, but the propagation gods were only operating in one direction. Still in the Twilight Zone haze, I used the computer to find his phone number and placed a call to his home. Even though it was only past 9 p.m. here in Washington State, it was past midnight in Pennsylvania. Nevertheless, I figured if he was on the air that he would answer the phone. Well, sunspots, ozone layer, Twilight Zone effect, or whatever, Terry nearly fell off his chair. He was as shocked as I was, and we had a great twisted pear rag chew. I told him I was coming back to Pennsylvania in a few weeks on business and asked if we could meet. Terry was all for it and hoped to be able to get in touch with my other Elmer Jody, K3JZD. I picked up the August issue of World Radio and started through it. Again, the ozone layer opened up and sucked me in. On page 25, I began reading a story about the Skyview Radio Society near Pittsburgh. And there in the upper right panel was a picture of Terry, K3HKR, and a caption saying he was the raffle winner last year. I just could not believe this was happening. First the QSL cards, then the 80 meters, then the phone call, and now I had a vision of my old buddy. This was too spooky. 40 years had gone by, but amateur radio was an anchor for our friendship. A few weeks later in Pittsburgh, Terry and I met for lunch, and we shoveled down French fries and iced tea. We shared memories, filled in the years, and looked at the pictures of wives, kids, and grandchildren. It was as if time was standing still and waiting for two ham operators to catch up. We reluctantly had to end our eyeball QSO, but promised not to let 40 more years slip past. We have chatted on the phone since then, but not on the air. The wonderful folks who brought us BPL, broadband over power line, kept 40 and 80 meters filled with S9 noise level here to my QTH. As we get further into the new sunspot cycle, Terry and I will be trying other bands and other modes and keeping in contact. We are hoping for a roundtable QSO with a few more of the gang from the Berg. Thus ends my tale of ozone holes, sunspots, and lost but not forgotten ham friends. My advice to you is simple. If you enter the Twilight Zone, just call CQ. You might be surprised who will answer. Remember, when all else fails, ham radio. Well, I thank Ed McLaughlin, W6OLA, for this very nice nostalgia piece. Folks, just reminding you that we're reading for you in digest format, World Radio Online for March 2009. This is Bob Zeta. My call is N1BLF. Let's go to emergency communications. The title, High Visibility. Author Jerry Wellman called W7SAR. It was a disaster waiting to happen, but it didn't. Janet and I were returning home along a busy feeder highway. Ahead, I noticed the sheriff's car in the central lane at the intersection with his lights on. I moved to the outside lane, as the law directs, and stopped at the red light. He was motioning me to stop and stay put. I noticed that he wanted the traffic to stop so he could push a stalled van from the center lane intersection to the connecting road's curb. Without too much thought, I put my car in park and jumped out to help push. I noticed the van had an older driver and several kids inside. It was quite a push, and the slushy road didn't help. After pushing the van to a safe spot, the deputy shook my hand and said thanks. It was only then I realized the light had turned green and traffic was shooting past his marked and lighted car and my car, which was just parked and unlighted in the lane of traffic. I was shocked that I'd left Janet in the vehicle parked in a lane of heavy traffic on a Saturday afternoon. Visibility was good and no one hit my vehicle, and perhaps the sheriff car in the central lane had caused people to notice my car wasn't moving. I was, however, grateful no one hit my car, which could have caused great injury to my wife. I also realized that I was dressed in a rather drab clothing, as was the deputy. Neither of us had high-visibility coats or vests. There are new Department of Transportation requirements for wearing visibility clothes if you're near traffic along some highways. I believe we were in violation and at risk of injury. I'm not in the habit of pushing cars out of busy intersections, and also don't carry high-visibility vests on my errands when driving Janet's car. I presume the deputy, who was in his sage green uniform, had an orange vest in his car. We were lucky. I'm making amends. I've put a reflective vest in all of my vehicles where I can quickly grab it. It makes sense to have it available for every event where I'm helping someone else, or perhaps fixing my own tire, or checking a trailer connection. When I experienced those cars shooting by, I realized the danger we face. In your grab-and-go materials, please include an orange or green vest. Make sure it has reflective material if you need to wear it after dark. I'm now including such items in all of my base camp gear as well. Safety is something we need to consider at all times. Considering visible things, I stumbled across an online auction for a VHF portable radio. It caught my attention because it was, drumroll please, orange. It was just too cool. I had to have this radio. Not only was it a model that I could put to use, it was orange. The best part of the deal was that it had been broken, and I had the part to fix it. A good deal for me. The auction price was reasonable, and I was able to fix the radio. I now have an orange radio. I've always thought that amateur operators would flock to purchase radios that were bright orange or yellow. In the weeks I've carried my orange radio to several MCOM-related events, others have also noticed the radio's colors. It didn't matter what band it was or even if it worked. It was orange. Over many years, I've encountered three radios or battery packs that were not gray or black or white in the case of a Marine band portable. The E.F. Johnson 5100 series radios, an off-brand UHF portable, an ICOM FRS radio, and an ICOM battery pack made by Alexander Battery. I found lights and headsets and vests and pens and notebooks and coats and cable ties and even cars. I owned a bright lime green Plymouth Duster some years ago. But radios, they're scarce. The radio I found is typically used by federal wildlife personnel, and it was just cool to have it in my emergency communications gear. Maybe some marketing people will realize that there are others like me who might be tempted to spend some scarce cash and buy an orange radio. Some months ago, a reader wrote, "It's too bad that MCOM groups and training requirements don't include some kind of physical fitness standard." At the time, I chuckled and considered from a personal perspective that I was certainly trained and certified and equipped and could handle any assignment possible. And then came the wake-up call. The young kid I'd hired to mow my lawn didn't show up, and the grass was pretty deep and in desperate need of cutting. It took some effort to get the cobwebs out of the lawnmower, and took many pulls on the rope before the machine chugged to life. Good so far. We live on a corner lot. One of the selling points decades ago was the large lot and lack of a neighbor on one side. That's the room for the tower. The lawn is our summer joy. The grandkids love to visit and play in the yard. We've worked over many years to get the lawn nice and nurture trees that finally match the tower in height. I began the mowing task. With half the lawn tackled, I'd noticed that the task was a little more difficult than last year, and I was breaking into a sweat. After a few more swaths of the mower, I was feeling out of energy and needed to take a break. I'd not even been mowing for 30 minutes, and I was out of energy. With considerable effort, I finished the mowing, but was too spent to attempt trimming. I could not believe how tired I was. My heart was rapidly beating, and I felt lightheaded. I just sat down on the lawn and leaned against a tree, gathering enough strength to get into the house and rest. It struck me that my physical condition had deteriorated significantly. What was an easy task even a year ago was now very challenging. I consulted the family medical clinic, and the checkup was good, except the final report said I was in need of exercise. I wasn't overweight. I wasn't suffering from a specific ailment. The doctor just kindly suggested I get away from the computer and just walk around more. I began walking more and getting on the bike more, but not enough. As I age, I notice that it's not as easy to tackle physical tasks as it once was. If I spend the day washing and cleaning the cars, I'm done for the day. I spent the morning hauling materials to a youth camp and was tired after toting several boxes from the parking area to the campsite. I cannot imagine what might happen if I needed to haul a lot of radio gear to a command site several miles at high altitude over moderate terrain. I also suspect that many of you are in the same condition. We are not as young and fit as we once were. Even if we're not overweight, we face a challenge of stamina. In further medical consultations, the advice wasn't something I wanted to hear. I was told that as I age, I'm slowing down, and it will take focused effort to remain in shape and maintain my energy reserves. I'm not ready to order the late-night TV exercise video offer, but I am doing all I can to walk stairs, eat right, exercise regularly, daily, and not yearly, and be aware of my limitations. I agree with the reader. It's too bad we don't have physical fitness requirements for some MCOM roles. As our operator pool grows older, it's something we might want to contemplate. Until next month, best wishes from Salt Lake City. This piece was thanks to Jerry Wellman, W7SAR, titled High Visibility. Let's change the pace for a moment and comment about a new product. MFJ, they're the manufacturer. MFJ Short Mobile Whips. There's no need to drill holes on your car or stop to remove your antenna before entering your garage to get on high-frequency HF. The MFJ Short HF Mobile Whip antennas are designed to let you mount an HF antenna with just a 5-inch magnet mount. Attached to a magnet mount or trunk lip mount, the super low profile of the antenna makes it easy to go in and out of your garage and be ready to work HF as soon as you hit the road. The MFJ-23XX series are constructed like the MFJ Ham Tennis series, but stand only 36 inches tall and are collapsible to 25 inches for easy storage. They are thin, lightweight, have a very low wind resistance, and use a 3/8 24 stud connector and can handle 250 watts BEP. An adjustable stainless steel whip allows for minimum SWR. If you're interested in that, it's a good idea to think new products once in a while. That's about the MFJ Short Mobile Whips. Let's take a peek now at what is happening at the Quarter Century Wireless Association, QCWA. Titled Tough Birds in the Morning Mists, the author is Alan Pickering, KJ9N. The Quarter Century Wireless Association is not for everybody, although there are no official discriminatory barriers other than the simple time-bound qualifications of one's first amateur license at least 25 years before making an application to join independently or as part of an established chapter. There is a self-selection process always at work. We are the elite, the proud, and the many. We are the QCWA. We are the elite, having been practitioners of amateur radio with devotion and energy given freely and generously to the advancement of the wireless communications art, always proud of our achievements in continuous learning, growth, and advancement, and we are a part, an important standard-setting part, of that fraternal company which strives for perfection in all that we do and achieve and say. Not every licensee wants to adapt their amateur radio interest to those standards of practice and operating skill, which is fine. But the QCWA is nevertheless self-limiting in its membership, even though through the years we have become many, with almost 8,000 licensees proudly listing their QCWA affiliation on their QSL cards, jackets, and caps. UCWA members are the kingfishers of the skies, those tough, full birds who are legendary masters of the morning mists. If you like to drive the coastal roads and highways of America, you will have seen the nests of the kingfishers, more properly called the osprey, lifted up on high platforms and poles near freshwater lakes and estuaries. Ospreys are independent pairs, choosing mates for life, and their lifestyle is bold and courageous. They are picky about their food. 99% of their daily intake consists of live fish only. Utilizing their exceptionally sensitive eyesights, they perch high above the water on their living platforms, and when they sight fish below them, they strike their prey directly, rotating each catch so the head of the fish is held forward to streamline its body as the osprey returns with its catch to enjoy feeding back at its nest. Ah, yes, the osprey nest. Each is a work of art consisting of 75 to 100 entwined sticks, rope, and perhaps some grass. The osprey mates, delivers up to 5 eggs, nurtures and creates an osprey family from that one location, returning each spring to renew the same nest and there initiate another family if at all possible. Amateurs who live in osprey country frequently find ospreys choosing the center of their rotary beams as ideal platforms upon which to build a nest. A couple of years ago, an osprey family chose my log periodic as the place to settle down, but I could not welcome their household since one of their building pieces was a yard-long stretch of barbed wire fencing that tended to create an electrical short in the log periodic beam I was using at the time. Ospreys and CQWA members have much in common. Like the osprey, we tend to settle down in locations as high above mean sea level as possible in order to improve our RF propagation, of course. And when we hear DX stations like the osprey, we pounce on them at once. As amateurs, we find ourselves operating at odd hours of the day or night, chasing that elusive weak signal out there in the morning or evening mist, even as the osprey often fish at dawn and dusk when their prey is sluggish and less likely to be paying attention. If there is any standard for QCWA member operations at any time of day or night, it is probably that old, old aphorism that goes, if all you ever do is all you've ever done, then all you'll ever get is all you ever got. That is why the QCWA is always seeking to improve amateur wireless operations, pushing forward to become an example of amateur wireless at its very best. And we join the Quarter Century Wireless Association because birds of a feather flock together. That is, we find satisfaction in our relationship with others who think and act as we do. No wonder, then, that Thomas Friedman wrote in his latest book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, that the act of mixing with others is vital to the continuation of life itself. Friedman warned us to stay away from places where birds do not fly, where people do not mix, where ideas do not get sparked, friendships don't get forged, stereotypes don't get broken, collaboration doesn't happen, trust doesn't get built, and freedom doesn't ring. We are at our best when we flock together with birds of the same feather, and we can be associated with other kingfishers whose goals and objectives parallel our own. I like to think of the QCWA as a similar group of very special leaders, men and women who are certain of their leadership skills and clear in their purposes, making order out of chaos and sense out of nonsense. The QCWA is not for everyone. Rather, it is for the elite, the proud, and the many who seek to make a difference in the excellence of our amateur operating practices. If you have survived 25 years since first licensure, you have met the minimum qualifications required to join us. We welcome the Kingfishers of Amateur Radio. You may be one of them. Think about it, please, as a great way to begin a new year within the amateur fraternity. The invitation stands open at www.cqwa.org. Until the next time, 73 and 88, D.E. Allen, KJ9N, Da Da Da. Well, I thank Alan for that lighthearted piece for the QCWA. If you want to be in touch with Alan Pickering, his call is KJ9N, Kilo Juliet 9 November. He can be reached by sending postal mail to 31860, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, Grandy, G-R-A-N-D-E, Road, Taylor Grand Road, Duet, D-U-E-T-T-E, Florida, F-L, 33834. It's a lot simpler if you just plain email them, folks. Lowercase KJ9N at ARRL.net. Well, let's go back to the classroom, folks. Hams with Class. Visit to the Hall of Science. The author, Carol, with an E, Perry, called WB2MGP. First, an editor's note. Due to the sudden death of Carol's mother, we are presenting a previously published article this month. This column was chosen because the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club needs your help. The amateur radio exhibit at the museum is in danger of being permanently closed due to a major renovation under the supervision of a new director. The new director does not feel the ham radio exhibit is of enough interest to warrant space in the museum. The club has an online petition that you can sign freely. I don't know if it's printed correctly, however, folks, so I'm not going to give it to you because, as anybody would know who works in computers, if you get one digit or letter wrong, it's not going to fly. It's going to come back to you as undeliverable. So just try to get involved with the Hall of Science, and that would be a big, big benefit for the children's education. The article goes, I took two of my granddaughters to the incredible Hall of Science in Queens, New York. I know we were in for a fun time when I spotted the antenna array on the roof. We were greeted by Tom Galero, KC2CBA, who was our host at the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club station called WB2JSM, Whiskey Bravo 2 Juliet Sierra Mike. Emily, age 7, has been practicing Morse code for several months and was very excited about getting on the air. Haley, age 4, likes to follow whatever her older sister does. We were really lucky that day because a Santa Claus special event station was seeking youngsters to speak with. The girls were thrilled to make contact with a W06T, W6S, Mickey Hicks, who plays Santa around holiday time in December. He was nice enough to talk to Grandpa, too, and we both remembered when he spoke with the students in my ham radio class several years ago. Emily was so excited about receiving her first QSL card that she brought it into school. Her science teacher called me and invited me to do a radio demonstration at her school. Like most things in our amazing hobby and service, one thing always leads to another. Two other interesting club members I met at a subsequent visit to the HOSARC. Remember, folks, that's the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club. Were Thomas Tumino, N2YTF, and Rob Smith. Tom was good enough to supply me with the background history of the museum station taken from oral histories from Tom Galero and Steve Greenbaum, along with other sources. The HOSARC is housed in the New York Hall of Science, a children's science museum, which was originally built as an exhibit space for the 1964-65 World's Fair. The original building, now much built upon and expanded, resembled then and still does an amoeba, and is quite unusual. Tom is quick to point out that the vital part of their demos is the goodwill expressed by countless hams around the world who have graciously spent their time in the air with the youngsters, answering their questions about ham radio. Keeping the station running is a major effort, especially as the hall itself is a very dynamic place, where buildings are built and remodeled every few years. Forcing HOSARC to reroute their multiple 350-foot coax runs and to move their equipment. It's only through the tireless efforts of the members and the kind donations from the likes of Kenwood, MFJ, ARRL, World Radio, and countless others that they have managed to stay on the air. The club is now on the third reincarnation of their Radio Shack. They are active on 160 meters through 70 centimeters, digital modes, and satellites. They also run an internet-linked repeater system on 2 meters and 70 centimeters. They participate in contests, traveling and operating contest stations, holding licensing classes, and traveling to faraway hamfests such as Timonium and Dayton. Through the years, they've participated in field day, picnics, fishing trips, and holiday parties. The club has participated in Christmas visits to Flushing Hospital using HDs to talk to Santa and give out presents. If you want to meet with a group of dedicated and fun hams, I suggest you contact them at www.qsl.net/HOSARC or stop by and visit in person. Since our initial visit, my girls and I have returned 3 times for more fun at the museum and a guaranteed good time at the WB2JSM Shack. Once again, ham radio is the key to fun and learning. That article was presented by Carol Perry, called WB2MGP. The title was Visit to the Hall of Science in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, before I go out of time here, I want to give you a list of ham fests during the next few weeks, most especially in March of 2009. Let's begin with Massachusetts, the Framingham Massachusetts Amateur Radio Association Spring Flea Market will take place on March 29, 2009 at the Keith Tech School in Framingham, Massachusetts from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. In New Hampshire, the Contucook Valley Radio Club Hamfest holds its annual Hamfest at the Henniker Community School on March 29th also from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Features will include speakers, amateur radio license examinations, indoor vendor tables, HD raffle, door prizes, and refreshments. It's always a good time up in the great state of New Hampshire. New York, the Greater Buffalo Hamfest, Saturday, March the 7th at the Ismailia Shrine Center, 1600 Southwestern Boulevard, Route 20, West Seneca, New York. In Minnesota, the home of the Courage Anti-Ham System, the 27th Annual Midwinter Madness Hobby Electronics Show and Flea Market on Saturday, March 2809 from 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Buffalo Civic Center, Buffalo, Minnesota. For more information there, you could call up area 763-537-1722 or visit www.k0ltc.org. Great state of California, the Pasadena Radio Club Special Event Station, Sunday, March 22nd, in conjunction with the first Pasadena Marathon, will be operating in the general portion of the 10 through 80 meter bands beginning at 0600 hours Pacific Standard Time. State of Illinois, Sterling Rock Falls Amateur Radio Society Hamfest in March of 2009. That's on March the 8th. At the Shelland Middle School, 1706th Avenue, Sterling, Illinois. Michigan, the 49th Annual Michigan Crossroads Hamfest and Radio Swap on Saturday, March 14. From 8 a.m. in the morning to 1 p.m. in the afternoon, it's being held at the Marshall High School, 701 North Marshall Avenue, Marshall, Michigan. West Virginia, Charleston Hamfest, Saturday, March 21st, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Coonskin Armory, 1707 Coonskin Drive, Charleston, West Virginia. Of course, folks, I give you this information because it's really a very good way to get involved in amateur radio if it's been tickling your fancy but you've never done much about it. If you're anywhere near any of these hamfests, any time of the year, it's just a great experience to see all that is available for this marvelous hobby known as amateur radio. So go visit one of those hamfests or swap meets. Call them what you want. It's always fun, and you'll be amazed if you've never been to one what kind of stuff they can really lay out for you. Hi, hi. Now, before I leave you today, I'm going to give the YLs a little time. YLs are the young ladies of amateur radio, also known as women. An article here, it's titled, Are You Keeping Your Resolutions? The author, Cheryl Muir, M-U-H-R, her call is N0WBV. I'll give you as much as I can from it. Almost everyone makes New Year's resolutions, including me. We are well into 2009 now, making it a good time to sit back and see how your resolutions are going. For one, I resolved to get on the air more. There are a number of nets that are always looking for YLs to get on and make contacts. Participants need YL contacts for either the special awards of the net, including tag teaming as a husband and wife contact. Maybe you are needed for a special band because your name starts with a certain letter, or just because there aren't enough YLs participating. Second, I resolved to work on my YL awards. I am still working on my YL Century Club, where I have to talk to 100 different YLs. I'm also working on YL Worked All States, YL DXCC, and 25 different DXYLs. Unfortunately, all these have to be worked from the home call. So even though I have made my quota in general, it wasn't always from the home call. This can be one of the minor heartbreaks for a paper chaser on a DX position, where you work the one person you needed from the home call sign. Third, I resolved to try to get more YLs on the air with me. I have actually worked on this one. The Colorado YLs recently made sure to get all their members on the air during a regular meeting. No repeaters were allowed in this case, and for some ladies, it was the first time they had ever been on the air. Others had been on local nets or local repeaters talking to their OM, that's the old man, boyfriend, husband, call them what you want. It was great to see how their eyes lit up and making the contacts. We kept talking all the way home from the meeting. Lastly, I resolved to not just listen, waiting to answer someone else's call. So how are you stacking up so far? What radio resolutions did you make? And are you keeping them? Let me know. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this brings me pretty close to an hour's worth of time for the digest reading of World Radio Online, March 2009, here on the Courage Handy Ham System. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801, in the great United States of America. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may reach at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My ham radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, a geographic location in the dark of morning here, is in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're a suburb of New Bedford, the number one fishing port in the United States of America. Did you know that? It's true. And we also are the biggest scalloper supplier for all you people who love that yummy seafood. I say 73s and thanks a lot. Continue to have a great springtime and look forward to a better summer propagation period. 73, 88.